The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It is a great pleasure to welcome Nicholas Wapshot, the author of Samuelson Friedman, The Battle Over the Free Market, a new book that takes us back to the 20th century and then forward to the 21st century to settle a debate that cannot be settled between two schools of economic thinking, one represented famously by John Maynard Keynes, the other represented famously by Friedrich Hayek, the Hayekians, the Keynesians, but their disciples, Samuelson and Friedman. So we begin with an event. It is June of 1980. Inflation has peaked. Runaway inflation has peaked, but they do not know. Paul Volcker is in the audience. He is now the man who's making decisions at the Fed. And the speaker is Milton Friedman of the Chicago School. Nicholas, congratulations and a very good evening to you. And your book is a treat. If I'd read it as a younger man, I would have been less perplexed by the events of these last decades when I realized that these men, these significant economic theoreticians, were intimate friends and correspondents and cared a great deal about each other and their families. But this day, in June of 1980, Milton Friedman launches an ad hominem attack on the decisions made by Paul Volcker. You describe him with his tall frame in the audience, sticking above all the other seated guests. And the ad hominem attack is blunt. What is the case that Milton Friedman makes? And how is it that Paul Volcker is able to respond, "Oh, Milton"? Good evening to you, Nicholas.
Good evening, John. It's a great pleasure to talk to you again. Yeah, this is an absolutely key moment in the battle between the Hayekians and the Keynesians, but 50 years later after the event. And they are making decisions about exactly how to purge hyperinflation from the system. By the 70s, everybody was in despair. The Keynesians couldn't understand why runaway inflation had taken place. Milton Friedman thought he had the idea, which was to do with the monetary theory. How much money is in the system guides how much inflation there is. And so he says what you ought to do is just turn the taps off or turn the taps down. Volcker's doing this, but he's not doing it as Milton wants. Milton wants a set program. Volcker's playing it by ear. And actually, as it turns out, as you say, he didn't know he got it right, but he had got it right. And so Milton, thinking that Volcker was doing something completely wrong because he wasn't following what Milton said, attacked him in this public forum, which is most unusual. Of all the great academic debates and political debates, the people behind the scenes rarely hit each other in public. But Milton was a very interesting character. He was a Brooklynite, and he was a little feisty. I mean, I say little. He's about 5'7". He was a little chess prodder. He had arguments with everybody. He was... Groucho Marx once sang a song saying, whatever it is, I'm against it. And Milton had that reputation for always being the contrarian in the room. And he was contrary when it came to politeness, too. And that is that he should have kept quiet and mentioned it to Volcker behind his back. In private, behind closed doors. But he didn't. He launched a very public attack on Volcker.
Samuelson, Paul Samuelson, who is... the esteemed economist and post-Keynesian, that's his own term for himself, at MIT, writes of this event, "I am not one loath to criticize the Federal Reserve. There is no other activity that so much adds to the economist's professional and self-esteem. One of the joys of your book is how dry their wit is. I wonder if they take a course in it before they get their PhDs." All right, let's go forward 26 years. Milton Friedman leaves us at the age of 94 in November of 2006. However, he has a posthumous column in the Wall Street Journal published the next day. Money Matters. In that, he makes the same case he's made for decades. What is that case, despite all of the vicissitudes of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and good heavens, we're about to come to the Great Recession? What is the case, Nicholas?
The case is that the Keynesians had come to the conclusion that you could actually throw money around. You could borrow it endlessly. If your economy was in trouble, if it was sinking, you just hosed money at it. And people from Hayek onwards, on the conservative side of this debate, would argue, hold on a minute, there's a cost to all of this. There will be a cost. It'll come out in inflation or one way or another. Something will go terribly wrong. And the Keynesians said, oh, leave that to us. We'll sort it out. And what his posthumous message was actually money still matters. Money's still important. There is a price to all of this. Like there's a price to quantitative easing, he would say today. He didn't live in the age of quantitative easing officially, which is where governments borrow their own money effectively in order to pump more money into the system. Milton believed that, and there's some logic in it. If you think about it for a second, it's common sense. The more money there is in a system, the higher prices will go as more money chases fewer goods.
The price is paid beginning a year later. And it's like falling down the steps. November of 07, Fannie and Freddie report a $2 billion loss. And then we go through what is a hall of shame. What we have now is IndyMac fails in California. We also have the questions at BNP Paribas, meaning this is a global crisis driven by the real estate excesses. The following March, Bear Stearns fails. After that, with J.P. Morgan and the government stepping in, there's the term Frankenstein in financial engineering. Lehman's fails in mid-September of 2008. The panic sets in. Congress gets involved. TARP and the Great Recession is on. I mention all this very quickly, Nicholas, because Samuelson's still with us. He doesn't leave us till 09. And Friedman is gone. At this point, what does the Great Recession illustrate between these two poles? Samuelson arguing post-Keynesian when in a recession, Friedman saying no, control the amount of money and the velocity of money, and the market will take care of itself.
Yeah, the great irony, of course, was that the person who actually allowed so much cheap money was Alan Greenspan, at the time considered a total maestro when chairman of the Fed. And he was charged with ensuring there wouldn't be a recession after the terrorist attacks on America of 2001. And he put, effectively, money rates down to almost zero. So it didn't cost anything to borrow anything. And cheap money, however, did, as you say, it allowed people to lend money to people who really couldn't afford to pay it back if there was a real interest rate. So people were... In the old days, when you wanted to buy a house, you had to prove to the lender that you could afford the repayments. But in those early 2000s, not at all. It was given to all sorts of people. And the crisis took place when actually, strangely, a French bank spotted that there was about to be a terrible event. That is, that the banks, American banks in particular, wouldn't lend to each other overnight. The whole system would freeze up. So they sent a small email saying, don't lend anything to American banks. Don't pass it on to American banks anymore. That was spotted, and it triggered the events of 2008 when the whole financial structure froze.
And crowding in on this now are the Keynesians, I believe. Is that a way to characterize the Obama administration? I remember Paul Volcker's tall frame sitting next to the Senator Obama at candidacy. It was an event in Florida. Are the Keynesians vindicated by the remedy for the Great Recession?
Well, there's no other remedy, it turns out. The conservative economists, either to their shame or to their great credit, kept quiet. They didn't have a solution at all. But the Keynesians did, or the post-Keynesians did, and they said, you just have got to hose more money at the system. It's a bizarre thought. In fact, of course, it was George W. Bush's plan that Obama put into effect. It was slightly before Obama arrived, and Obama just swallowed it wholesale and went off with it. But it was made up by Keynesians. So George W. presided over two things. Alan Greenspan, who was considered a genius, but then lent his policies, his brain really, to endorsing the fact that cheap money was essential to prevent America going into, or the world going into, a recession. And then, at the end of George W.'s time, when the banks started to freeze up, as one of the Keynesians said, everybody's a Keynesian in a foxhole. The fact is that when you're up against the wall and nothing you can do except borrow money is the solution, you borrow money. And that's what happened. And since then, money has cost almost zero. There has been no interest rate. If you're a saver, you haven't got any money in your savings account. You've got no interest per year. People on retirement have suffered as a great result of this. And it's difficult to know who to benefit, except for the fact that the whole world economy didn't go off a cliff as it might have done. We might have ended up... Ben Bernanke, who was also chairman of the Fed a little later, did a study and came to the conclusion that had it not been for the intervention of that Bush-Obama solution, that there would have been a recession or a depression even worse than the 29-31 depression in the United States. And he's a conservative. I mean, you know, there's nothing in it for him to get it wrong.
We've laid out what we can so far know of this debate between Keynes and Hayek, between Samuelson for Keynes and Friedman for Hayek. So back to the beginning, the birth of Mr. Friedman and the birth of Mr. Samuelson and their education in Depression America. The book is Samuelson Friedman, The Battle Over the Free Market. Nicholas Wapshot is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It's fun to talk to Nicholas Wapshot. His new book is Samuelson Friedman, The Battle Over the Free Market. This is high-end economics in the 20th century reaching into the 21st. The 20th century, however, was darkened by the Great War, which bloodied the families of continental Europe and pulled U.S. into the tangle that we know resulted in the Second War, a settling of scores that darkened the earth. At the same time, economics coming out of the First War into the Great Depression, beginning famously, infamously, 1929. This is the period of youth, an experiment by Milton Friedman and Paul Samuelson. We begin with Paul Samuelson. He was born in Gary, Indiana. His folks, unusual, Frank and Ella, his folks fostered him out to a farm couple that had no relationship for several years as a child. As he
literally asked, farmed him out.
And he could not settle that. It was a mystery to him. They did eventually take him back and recognize.
To his dying day, he did not know. The parents never explained to him what and why that took place. But it undermined him considerably. It meant that he gripped onto any authority figure passing by for some sort of certainty. Let me hold your hand, please.
He sets off, however. He's extremely well-educated by himself. And he goes to the University of Chicago as a teenager, plunges right into it, and immediately is rewarded with scholarships and teachers' attentions and eventuality. There is a moment in Columbia, then a moment back in Chicago. What is the opinion of Paul Samuelson when he first reads the Keynesian books that come out of the 1920s and the 1930s? The great book is 1936. What is his opinion in those days of Keynes?
He was blown away, as so many American economists were, particularly out of Harvard. He was out of MIT across the river, but it's the same thing, really. They suddenly discovered that here was a manual that no one particularly understood. It's very difficult to understand the general theory. It makes no sense much. but it offered a spirit of can do. Here's a solution, maybe. Let's try it. And they were all convinced that should be the case. And Samuelson picked up the baton and he ran for Keynes for the rest of his life, for the next 80 years.
Chicago makes him an offer, but he turns to MIT. Why, Nicholas?
He's offered a scholarship on the understanding that he doesn't continue at his institution, which is Chicago. So he goes actually off to Harvard. He gets a PhD thesis there, which actually wins him the Nobel Prize many years later. The people who came to judge the PhD thesis looked at each other when they read it and said, well, I suppose he's right, is he? We got no idea. I mean, Samuelson was, he had two brains. He was so smart that he understood things which no one else could do. His judgment, that's what we're now discussing, whether he was right about his judgment. But certainly he set the tone for the whole of economics. If macroeconomics was invented by John Maynard Keynes, which it was, Samuelson was the ultimate high priest and the writer of the key gospel, which was Samuelson on Economics, which I read economics. Everybody that I met who read economics bought that book, which costs roughly in today's money $150, revised every 2 years. He made himself a multimillionaire by the age of 30.
Yes, the book after the Second War becomes a textbook. He's at MIT establishing the department. It's all in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I understand that. What's important here is when he gets this tangle with Friedman, becomes explicit when he's approached by Newsweek magazine reorganizing itself in the 1960s after purchased by the Washington Post. They offer him a column. At first, he's reluctant. Why?
Well, he's very grand, Paul Samuelson. He's immensely rich. He's got, and he spends it mostly on his family. He has lots and lots of children. One time, the diapers bill, the coming out of the Samuelson family, would have broken most families. but he thought he didn't need it. And somebody pointed out what the circulation of Newsweek was. And he thought, oh, well, there's some extra sales there. But it did mean that he would get involved in the day-by-day or the week-by-week conversation about economics. And pitched against him, this is very good editing, was Milton Friedman, which was his total antithesis. And they were great friends. They were as if separated at birth, as if they were twins separated at
right.
birth.
Samuelson was born in 1915. Friedman's born in 1912. His parents are, well, he loses his father early. And he's educated at Rutgers, then Brown, and then Chicago Economics, and marries very well. Rose Director, his wife, was also an economist. And he comes to the Keynesian theory, but is the polite term disputatious? Is that his personality?
It is. He's a feisty little... He's a street fighter. You know, Samuelson had acquired a sort of almost aristocratic disdain for regular people. I mean, that's not true. He liked the common people. But he could affect a disdain for people who disagreed with him because, after all, he'd won. The established economic theory was Keynesian, and he was riding atop it. But Milton Friedman had a reputation to make, and he wanted particularly to undermine the key person in the land, which was still John Maynard Keynes. He picked up the baton that Hayek left behind. And went in to fight on Hayek's behalf, although Hayek and Friedman fell out with each other, too.
I like
Friedman
the fact
would fall out with everyone.
Friedman understood to always punch up. That's what he was doing when he was in. Oh, by the way, Nicholas has unearthed the fact that Friedman invented the withholding tax. It was him when he worked in Treasury.
It's true. You see, Samuelson was so well off and so advanced, he didn't have to work for the Treasury in the 1930s. Friedman, who detested the New Deal, actually went to work for the New Deal. He and his wife, both of them detested the New Deal. But they had to, Friedman admitted, you know, I was very lucky. I got a job during the 30s.
The book is Samuelson.
Propping up the idea I didn't like.
The book is Samuelson Friedman, The Battle Over the Free Markets. These two men know each other, correspond regularly. They're now writing columns every third week in Newsweek. So it's the battle of the economists. And when we come back, let's push them into action with Richard Nixon's election. Nicholas Wapshot is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Nicholas Wapshot. His new book is Samuelson Friedman, The Battle Over the Free Markets. This is the story of the 20th century and all of the ups and downs of what was called politely the business cycle. We know it today as recession, sometimes depression. The idea that there will be panics in the market, prices will spike, and businesses will fail, and then we begin again. The polite way of talking about it is creative destruction, but we're talking about two men observing this with the vantage of writing alternate columns in Newsweek magazine with a circulation in the early 1960s of 14 million. I don't know where it topped, but we're going to plunge to the late 1960s with the election of Richard Nixon, because Milton Friedman, following Nicholas's reporting, had this wonderful theory of monetarism, and he wanted to put it into action. Milton Friedman's monetarism is very wordy. Is there one way we can say it that will satisfy Richard Nixon, whom we're about to talk to?
Well, he didn't convince Nixon, because Nixon was very slippery. And so whatever, Nixon understood everything. Friedman said he was the smartest president he ever met. And he'd met all of the post-war presidents almost, apart from maybe Truman. But Friedman's idea was quite simple, and that is you can't purge inflation from the system. But if you just allow the amount of new money in the system provided by the Federal Reserve to come to a trickle, that is, if you kept the faucet at a very low rate, then over the course of 2 years, it would purge any hyperinflation from the system, which was all well and good, except that the politicians didn't have enough time to wait for 2 years. They had a problem. Dixon was frightened. He thought, you know, nobody's ever been fired for inflation, but they have for unemployment. So what we don't want is a recession. So keep those taps open, Milton. Keep them open.
Nixon inherited 3.3% unemployment, 5.5% inflation, 4.25% interest rates. That's 1969. The inflation spikes. Now, nothing comparable to what we're about to see later in the 1970s, but it did spike and the direction was up. Nixon calls together in August of 71 at Camp David, famously or infamously, depending on how you feel about the decision made, Arthur Burns, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, John Connolly, the new Secretary of the Treasury, and Paul Volcker, who will become the Federal Reserve chairman. They impose a wage price freeze. One, what does Samuelson make of that decision at first?
Well, he's not in favor of that sort of intervention. He thinks that, that governments really shouldn't put the brakes on or lock up an economy in that way, because he thinks that there should be a living, breathing economy moving. On the other hand, he said it probably won't cause any harm. It might do a little bit of good. And certainly in terms of Nixon's mind, it meant that he was, first of all, he was doing something. What the public like is for the government to do something. If something's wrong, what's the government doing about it? And so Nixon conspicuously did something, which was, first of all, to hold the summit, which was conspicuous, as you say. But conspicuously, he didn't invite Milton Friedman, who was right. The only person actually who knew anything about it.
Who comes crashing through the door with his fists out, punching in all directions. Milton Friedman is appalled. Wage price freeze appalls him. And it's the opposite, or not even opposite, it's so alien to his understanding of monetarism. He made a prediction that it would fail, and he was right. We're both old enough to remember the recession of 1973-74. It was severe.
Yeah, but Nixon also knew that it would fail. He actually said at the meeting, this makes no sense, no economic sense. Everybody who's tried this fails, but I'm going to do it, because it looks as if I'm doing something important. The people understand a wage and a price freeze. Impossible to police.
Milton Friedman did have two recommendations to President Nixon that he half listened to and eventually entirely listened to. And Milton, the joy of reading Milton Friedman is you think he's going to stick to economics, and then he wanders off completely into policy. And the first one was float the dollar, which makes economic sense, and we understand it now. And the second one was end the draft. Nixon listened to him, but not immediately. Did Nixon ever credit Friedman with those recommendations?
Never at all. Nixon, if anything good happened, Nixon took the credit. If anything bad happened, he blamed it on anyone else. But Milton wasn't even mentioned. It was deeply offensive to Milton, who I think Milton really wanted to be rich and famous. He ended up being rich and famous, but he took his own route in the end. He didn't have to depend upon Nixon. Hayek told him, don't hang around with these politicians. They're all trouble. They'll only get you into deeper trouble. Leave them alone.
But Friedman wanted vindication, and he needed a president to be vindicated, or that was his opinion. Nobel Prizes crowd in and complicate everything. Sometimes, Nicholas, I think the irony of life is not getting over a disappointment, but getting over a success. It slows down productivity.
Gore Vidal said, it's not enough to have achieved success. It's important that everyone else, all of your other friends, must fail.
1970, the second economics Nobel Prize, I believe, goes to Paul Samuelson. 1974, the Nobel Prize goes to Friedrich Hayek, although he shares it with a Scandinavian liberal economist. And in 1976, Milton Friedman gets the phone call. But the controversy is why it took so long. And Friedman is chastised in the pages of the all-high New York Times by other Nobel Prize winners. Why?
Because he'd advised the Chilean government, which was a despotic military junta, on economics. I must say, he wiggled around a bit. There's no doubt that he did give them advice, but he claimed that he hadn't given them advice. He'd only given the people that he taught at Chicago, who had come from Chile, given them advice, and they'd taken the advice home. He was wriggling a bit, but it was a distraction. It had nothing important to say. Chile is a backwater. Nothing to do with that incident is important to the main debate that was going on.
We now wander into real trouble, big trouble. I have your statistics in front of me, Nicholas, and I'll read them off to people who are worried about inflation in the year 2021. Consider this, 1975, with Gerald Ford now president, having succeeded Richard Nixon's resignation, 6.9% inflation, 8.2% jobless, 76, 4.9% inflation, 7.8% unemployment, 78, 9% inflation, 6% unemployment, 79, 13% inflation. July of 79, Arthur Burns steps aside. The whole cabinet is asked for resignation, and enters Paul Volcker. Is Volcker a Keynesian or a monetarist? I couldn't decide on any given page.
He's a lifelong Democrat, which suggests that he would be a Keynesian. But actually, he's a secret monetarist. But he's not a Friedman monetarist. Milton Friedman had a very clear idea. It was mechanical. If you do this now, in 2 years' time, it will be solved. Just let's stick to that debate. But Paul Volcker just fiddled with the taps, on and off, on and off. So that's why Friedman attacked him in that meeting we spoke about at the beginning of the show. It was the fact that Volcker had not done it in a logical, progressive, useful, clever way. He hadn't followed Milton's advice, clearly. But the big picture, Volcker got absolutely right. And to his great credit, Jimmy Carter gets no credit for very much. He appointed Volcker, and then he left him alone to do the job. He said, fix hyperinflation, and Volcker was allowed to do it.
In an earlier book of yours, Nicholas, I'm reminded that Volcker emulates, maybe not consciously, FDR, who fiddled, who experimented day to day with the price of gold and with all the other elements, all the other tools in his government. Did Volcker ever remind you of FDR's, what the heck, let's try this?
In a way, you see, FDR was an instinctive Keynesian. And that is, again, I have the power to do things. The economy is on the floor, in which case I'm going to try a few things out. So he got Harold Ickes and said, why don't we just employ a lot of people sweeping up the national forests? Why don't we employ a lot of people to build a Hoover Dam? You know, anything to get some money into the system. What Keynes said in 1936, a bit late for the Great Depression, was let's do this systematically. Just borrow the money and spend it. That's what we come to today, which is with the stimulus checks and so on. In order to avoid what could have been a recession, the government has given money away. They've given check after check. Even Donald Trump signed the wretched checks. The important thing is that the money gets spent, that it gets into the system from a Keynesian point of view.
In April.
And everybody else says it's storing, you're going to store up trouble for later, which is what people say now. Inflation is in the cards, you know. It's just a matter of how long it's going to take before we get overtaken by a wave of inflation. And we'll have a new set of problems. We'll have a new set of contrary advice, which will lead us to impose policies which was the opposite of what we're just doing.
In April of 1980, inflation peaks at 16.32%.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
The Fed funds rate at that point was raised to 20%. Is that, and they eventually started lowering it. But Volcker's experimentation begins to pay off. Too late for Carter, because Ronald Reagan is elected in late 1980, takes office in early 81. This is an opportunity again for Milton Friedman, monetarist to the Reagan White House. Is he welcomed? Is he listened to? Is he satisfied?
No, he isn't. But Milton's never satisfied. That's just, you could put that on a T-shirt. Rose Friedman defended him all the time from unfair attacks. But she knew more than anyone else that actually he was a contradictory sort of character. But Friedman, had been very important in the rise of Reaganism, because he had been the economic advisor to the previous Reaganite, if you like, the original Reaganite, the mountain senator.
Barry Goldwater.
Barry Goldwater, exactly, yes. And written his economic policy. Barry Goldwater didn't know anything about it, but actually, Friedman, talking to the New York Times, laid out a manifesto, which was what he thought should happen to the economy. It would be identical to actually what Reagan did to the economy. But Milton was, maybe it was just the awkwardness of his personality. He was not an easy person to have around, because he was going to have a fight in any meeting that he held. And maybe that's what kept him away, but hugely influential. I think single-handedly, he's responsible for turning the Republican Party from a moderate conservative party, which echoed whatever the Democrats were doing, hugging the middle ground, trying to get votes from anywhere, to a libertarian party, which it has now become.
A note about the Reagan time. You end the chapter by saying the Reaganites, or the Reagan supporters in the White House, that included George Shultz, all these men know each other through several iterations of administrations. Mm-hmm. Milton Friedman was disappointed in Reagan, but he was blessed by Margaret Thatcher. Was Margaret Thatcher a monetarist?
She was, briefly. Margaret Thatcher was interesting because she was a scientist. She was actually a chemist. So she followed a logical progression, which meant that when she read something like Milton Friedman's monetarist tracts, she thought, this makes a lot of sense. The people who worked for her were more skeptical. So what she did was to get Milton Friedman to come over to Downing Street. She introduced them in the cabinet room to Milton Friedman, and then left Milton behind in order to give a lecture to all of these people. I've spoken to these guys. They're still fuming about being given a lecture by Milton Friedman on economics. But it gave Milton a second chance, because Reagan didn't follow Milton's advice, even though in broad principles he did, but he didn't allow Milton actually to run the show, which is what Milton was not happy about. But Margaret Thatcher gave him this second thing, which is, hey, we'll impose Friedmanite policies and see how it works. Total disaster, by the way. Total disaster. Political disaster as well as economic disaster.
Yes, and it led to a sustained unemployment, I believe, in Great Britain.
It did, yeah. Totally unnecessary. Manufacturing industry was totally destroyed by Margaret Thatcher. But that's something which never gets mentioned. But, I mean, she destroyed the manufacturing base of British industry.
It is now the 21st century. I'm speaking to Nicholas Wapshot. The new book is Samuelson Friedman, The Battle Over the Free Markets. When we come back, a toast by the chairman of the Federal Reserve to Milton Friedman upon his 90th birthday, reflecting upon the events of the 20th century. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Nicholas Wapshot's new book is Samuelson, Paul Samuelson, born 1915. Friedman, Milton Friedman, born 1912. That both men live well into their 10th decade in their 90s. At the 90th birthday of Milton Friedman, there is a toast by, I believe, Ben Bernanke, who was born in 1953, so a much younger man. He toasted Milton Friedman, and he said, you were right. You were right. We did it. What's he talking about, Nicholas?
Well, the common view is that the cause of the Great Depression, the Keynesian view, was that it was to do with sort of mass hysteria in the markets. The people were speculating crazily on borrowing money in order to, rather like people do with Bitcoin right now, they're borrowing money in order to get rich quick. And this, according to Keynes, all went terribly wrong. What Friedman did, which was a lot of hard work, he and Anna Schwartz, his partner in work, was to look back at the figures. And he came to actually a Keynesian conclusion. And that is, had the Federal Reserve provided cheap money to the banks at that time, there wouldn't have been a Great Depression and there wouldn't have been the bank bust that took place.
And
but from that he deduced that actually there was something in the monetary theory. And so he went off on that crusade, really.
Does that become, just logically, does that become a guidepost for Ben Bernanke, who becomes the first of the several chairs to ease the interest rates to near zero and to find quantitative easing and tapering? In other words, to keep the money flowing into the market. Is it Friedman's insight that leads them, Nicholas?
It is exactly. Ben Bernanke, by happy chance, is an expert on monetary theory of the 1920s and 1930s. And he congratulates Friedman on his 90th birthday, saying you were absolutely right. And he toasted him for it. But he didn't know that within a couple of years, he was going to be in the middle of exactly the same thing that Herbert Hoover was swamped by, which was an economic disaster, which was unfathomable. And what he did was turn to Friedman's solution, which was actually also Keynesian's solution, which is you borrow money and you hose it into the system as fast as possible.
What's wonderful about economics is that it's apocalypse after apocalypse. You never
Something you said about history, it's just one damn thing after the next.
Yes, but economics gives you the basis of the chill that sets into the economy and colors everything. Now, it is a moment to reflect about lessons learned. I have three lessons from your concluding chapter, Nicholas. Lesson number one, central banks can head off liquidity. Is that Friedman, Samuelson, or both of them?
Both of them.
Both of them.
Both of them.
And it's what we've illustrated. It's what QE means. Is it what taper means? Is taper another version of QE to them if they were here?
Yes. What it means is you introduce it gradually and you take it off gradually. It stands to reason. If you just stop it overnight, you're going to cause some economic harm. It's a bit like taking a patient from intensive care and throwing them straight out on the street. You've actually got to put them into a recovery first.
What we're coming to is a picture that is neither Keynes or Hayek. It's neither Samuelson or Friedman. It's everything all together, working together, but disputing that they're working together. I think of those wonderful Second World War cartoons made about Donald Duck when he would have the devil in one ear and the angel in the other ear whispering to him back and forth, back and forth. All right. Lesson number two. When you hit a recession, Keynesians to the fore. Is that a lesson that we've drawn from the last 100 years?
Yes. And it's the key lesson of Keynes, actually, which is that if you're in the bottom of a recession or if you have bad economic trouble, you impose Keynesianism. But at the top of the market, when you're doing very well to avoid inflation, you actually withdraw all of that support. The second part, nobody ever followed because the economic cycle and the electoral cycle mismatched. Over time, presidents were just anxious to get reelected. They weren't actually interested in getting it right. And the four-year term is not the same as the economic cycle length.
Isn't it wonderful, Nicholas, to have written a book about the past that is, in fact, about the present and the future?
Well, I'm very happy that it's arrived in time because now everybody's worried to death about hyperinflation.
Oh, of course we are.
And the amount of money. Hey, when it came to 2008, people thought it was reckless to borrow what was always called $1 trillion. In fact, it wasn't. It was $800 billion. But people didn't think it was enough. Well, never mind that. Biden's gone for $3 trillion. And it sailed straight through, too. Nobody's discussed this at all. All of those Friedman ideas have been put on the back burner for a while. They'll all come out again.
Yes, they'll be back. And the final lesson, we have less than a minute. The Hayek-Friedman legacy, Samuelson regarded as poison. I think that's harsh. Is it poisoned or is it part of the conversation?
I think that the original debate between Hayek and Keynes was so vituperative that it left a lasting legacy, that you can only discuss economics with a blackness in your soul, if you like. You hate the enemy. You make no attempt to accommodate them, even though, as you quite rightly point out, compromise, the finding of common ground, turned out to be the solution to everything.
Nicholas Wapshot is the author. The new book is Samuelson Friedman, The Battle Over the Free Markets, continuing. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.